这大厅这个，可能箱子错位呢。
哎呢，
老家一样啊，吃个药呗，说是对。
哎，忙。
这是不忙住是吧？嗯。
So, I mean, can one extrapolate from this saying that if, you know, for those rats that have been, you know, licked more and shown more kind of affection, they are also more alert. Because there is more receptors there.
Alert is similar.
Kind of more secure.
Oh, no. Sensitive. Lotsu Pusuta Venshe. Jingna Mavish, Chamzi, Kuyu Yana, Lopa, Roger Yang. More open.
Kind of.
So then
the Zizil Jacob, Zizil Jacob, Tangantri,
Zizil Jibur. Kuchamushin,
not really. Another chicken to lope
Kuyamas.
Dinner lawyer, my little woman. Jingna,
Rida, Ridididre, Chan, the handling is shower at that. Could a certain amount of
letter.
So
why is there more receptors as a result of more grooming and licking?
Why, in the sense of how that occurs?
Yeah, or.
Wonderful. That's where we're going.
Okay. Very good.
We know what the details are for. The glucocorticoid receptor in the hippocampus translate this inhibitory signal on to the hypothalamus. Its normal function is to produce less CRF. Because these animals have more glucocorticoid receptors, what that you would then expect is that they produce less CRF. And that's exactly what happens. And of course, because they produce less CRF, they also produce fewer of these stress hormones. And you can then actually measure the hormones in the bloodstream, whether you look at the pituitary hormone of ACTH, or whether you look at the adrenal hormone, the glucocorticoid, and what you find is that when you expose these adult animals to a period of stress, the animals that were reared by high-licking mothers show a more modest increase, as you said, more appropriate level. And so what these studies suggest is that the quality of maternal care alters the activity of a specific gene in a particular brain region, which then influences the way in which the adult offspring respond to stress. And in fact, you can actually show that this is a direct effect of maternal care. So you can take animals who were born to low licking and grooming mothers, and you can actually foster them at birth to animals that are high-licking mothers. And as adults, the animals that were born to low-licking mothers but reared by high-licking mothers are indistinguishable from normal high-licking offspring. And the opposite is also true. Now comes the details. How does this happen? How is it that the licking of the mothers stably influences the activity of the gene that produces the glucocorticoid receptor? Well, here in part is how the details are studied. We know, of course, that the genes can respond to signals that are external to the body, environmental events. The way this happens is that these environmental events cause changes in the brain's signaling systems, in neurotransmitters, in molecules that signal the cells. Those signals are detected by a receptor. The receptor activates a series of events in the cell that ultimately produces a critical class of proteins. These are called transcription factors. And the discovery of these proteins was actually critical in understanding the relationship between the outside environment and the inner gene. Because these transcription factors, which are responsive to the signals coming from outside of the cell and outside of the animal, can directly bind and interact with the DNA that comprises our genes. So they are the interface between the environment and the gene. The way the mother's licking alters the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor is through exactly these processes. And I'll bore you with the details. When the mother licks her pups, it activates an endocrine system that is closely related to growth. It is the system that involves the thyroid hormone. The thyroid hormones increase a particular neurotransmitter in the brain called serotonin. And serotonin activates a transcription factor which we call NGFIA. It is simply one of that class of proteins that can interact and signal the gene. And it is the interaction between NGFIA and the gene that is then critical for the effect of mother care on the glucocorticoid receptor. Now, what becomes absolutely crucial then is to understand where all of this is happening. How is NGFIA signaling the gene to produce more glucocorticoid receptors? Well, a gene is actually made up of at least two segments. One segment does the work. It produces the protein. The other segment is called a regulatory region. What it does is to tell the gene how active it should be. It turns the gene on, it turns the gene off. As you can imagine, the transcription factors work by binding to these regulatory sites and turning the gene on or inhibiting it. Now, the glucocorticoid receptor has a very long regulatory sequence, and I'm going to dare to show you it. And you, please feel free to ignore this information. But we worked 5 years to get it. And I'm going to show it.
Eric Lander has already explained about the meaningless jumbles of sequence of these terms.
They're meaningless, except there's one thing, and this is the source of interest. Within all of that jumble, there is a sequence of these nucleotides, and its job is to bind to NGFIA, which means you can actually identify the nucleotide sequence where this environmental event is occurring. And that's what makes it so important in terms of being able to understand how these effects are occurring. Now, we know that the mother's licking is causing an increase in this transcription factor, NGFIA. We also know, through this work, that NGFIA can bind to that regulatory sequence and turn on, activate the release of the gene. We can actually study, in the brain of the animal, the binding of this transcription factor, NGFIA, to this regulatory sequence. And so, in fact, it actually seems to be a fairly decent explanation of how mother's licking can increase the production of glucocorticoid receptors. The offspring that are reared by high-licking mothers produce more NGFIA, it binds to this regulatory sequence, and it causes the pup's brain to produce more glucocorticoid receptors. And so far, that's fairly simple. However, and this is where the but comes in. If you look in the pup, those pups, those infants that are raised by high-licking mothers, produce more NGFIA, more of the signal, than do those who were produced by low-licking mothers. But in the adult, when they've been away from their mothers, there's no difference whatsoever in the amount of NGF that they produce. And so that means that while increased levels of NGFIA can explain the increased activity of the glucocorticoid receptor gene in the pup, it can't possibly explain it in the adult because they're both producing the same amount of the transcription factor. So the signal is the same. What I'm going to tell you is that in the adult, what is crucial is not the amount of NGFIA that is produced. It is the ability of the NGFIA to bind to the DNA and to activate that DNA. So there are two ways, of course, that a signal can produce different effects. You can produce more of the signal, or you can produce more of the process that interprets that signal. And that's what the mother's behavior is actually doing.
So Lawrence is wondering whether we can really tease out the effect on the pup of this high level of licking and grooming, whether it is purely a physical process of just the contact of the tongue licking on the body of the infant pup.
Maybe something in the saliva of the mother's tongue
that's actually touching the skin, and that is triggering, or whether it is a kind of affection that is being shown that is.
So now, Amadi, you have been that object, you have been a kadi yusoro, that object, object dominant. Seven in that, Jelilia, Dishu Degro, the Buddha Chedum.
For example, one scenario is to give the rat, the mother, kind of a different kind of food, which could actually stay on the tongue, and then when the licking will get transferred, and can that have an effect?
Whether there's some aftertaste in the mouth, depending on her food, whether it's bitter or sweet and so forth, give her different types of food and see whether there's any difference in the
effect. We don't certainly know that, but there clearly are molecules that are transmitted. There are antibodies that can be transmitted through the mother's saliva to her pups. And the other component that's critical is how the pup experiences the licking, and that's an excellent question. Certainly the pup experiences the licking as tactile stimulation. But if you look at areas of the brain that are activated by licking in the pup, they include areas that are activated when, for example, a normal animal experiences a pleasurable event. And so it would seem reasonable to suspect that the pup's experience of licking goes beyond simply a touch.
So it's not just a function of a transfer of molecules from the saliva?
No, it would. The evidence would suggest that the touch and the interpretation of that sensory event is what's critical.
So there is an element of mental here as well.
I mean,
you wouldn't attribute the terms like mental probably to the animal, but...
I would.
Yeah, you would, okay.
But that's another discussion.
But it would be interesting, speaking for myself, it would be interesting from both sides to see whether the mental component from the mother is really crucial, or whether you could have some kind of a robotic device that would give a licking stimulation, a grooming stimulation, so we know there's no affection being given to the pup, one element. And the other element would be to see if somehow that kind of licking and grooming could be given to the pup, but not induce any sense of pleasure. You know, so try to tease out in both sides the mental element to see whether that is actually crucial. I think this is kind of the essence of what his audience is getting at.
Absolutely, of course. Okay, what I want to do now is to go back to the details of this story and to try to understand how the mother's licking could alter the ability of this transcription factor, NGFIA, to bind to the regulatory site on the gene. Now, to understand this, what we need to do is to understand that this diagram right here is essentially wrong and very misleading, but it's one that's very common. What we often do when we talk about genes is we talk about them as if they are passive molecules that receive transcription factor signals. The truth is very different. First, I'll give you the real world, and then I'll try to explain it image through imagery. This is actually a diagram of DNA in the helix, and in the real world,
helix,
the DNA wrapped around. In the real world, the DNA is not laid out flat. It's wrapped around proteins. And there's a very simple interaction that occurs between these proteins in the core and the DNA.
This is a drawing, yeah.
It's crystallography. Yes, it's not exactly what it, yes. No, it's an image, if you will, of what we think. These proteins that exist in the center are positively charged, and the DNA itself is negatively charged. And what that means is that you have a core that's negative, that's positive, and DNA wrapped around it that's negative. And they're very tight. They have a bond. And when the DNA, which it usually is, when the DNA is in this form, it cannot bind a transcription factor. Now, if you look up here in the upper right, what you can see faintly that may seem inconspicuous but is actually crucial is a little tail. It's actually a tail of these core proteins. These core proteins are called histones. And it's that tail that really tells the story. Now, what has to happen for a transcription factor to bind is that you must relax the relationship between the core proteins and the DNA. The way that occurs is through a very small modification, the addition of a small chemical group called an acetyl group is added onto these tails. When that acetyl group is added onto the tail, it neutralizes the positive charge of the core proteins, and that opens up the DNA. And now the transcription factors combine. And what we know now is that the normal activity of a gene is at least in part regulated by the modifications of this relationship between the histone proteins and the DNA. And they come on and they come off. And that's what must occur to permit the gene to be active. So it needs to be a very regulated event. It is not passive at all.
For example, we're talking about now two parts of the gene. There's a regulatory component, and it regulates and tells whether to switch on or off. So what kind of time scale we're talking about this process?
Very short. We're talking about something that is probably in a time scale of seconds, and that occurs over seconds, and that this addition of the acetyl group will come on and then be removed, which makes it very interesting. But of course, it cannot explain the stable effect of parenting on the way the gene is acting because it's coming constantly on and off. But there's another modification, another change in the chemistry of the gene that can. This is a modification or a change that is very stable, that lasts for years and usually the entire life of the animal. This is a modification that occurs not to the proteins, but to the DNA itself. Once again, we're talking about adding a rather simple chemical complex, a methyl group. It is added on to certain nucleotides that comprise the DNA, that are made up of the DNA. The methyl group is added on to cytosines. And this is a very stable relationship. The reason why this is critical and what it means in terms of the activity of the gene is that when a region in the DNA has been methylated, it attracts a series of proteins. And one of those proteins is a class of proteins called histone deacetylase. And what deacetylase does is to prevent, to block the acetylation of the histone tails, the protein tails. And what that means then is that if you cannot modify the tails, what you do is you preserve that very close relationship between the DNA and the core proteins. And that is a stable modification that prevents or reduces the gene's level of activity. This is the process that is active and responsive to maternal licking and grooming. When we look at adult animals that were reared by high or low licking mothers, what you find is that in the regulatory region that drives, activates the glucocorticoid receptor gene, there is greater methylation in animals reared by low licking mothers compared to high licking mothers. If you will, high licking prevents extensive methylation of the gene. And you can actually show that it occurs, oh, there's that horrible sequence again, that it occurs right at this site.
Which means they keep them more kind of open.
Exactly. The potential for regulation has been preserved by the mother's licking.
Whereas the opposite, it becomes more fixed.
Very fixed and closed. And you can actually look directly at that part of the regulatory site that binds NGFIA. And when you do, and this is just the measure of the degree to which this individual site has been methylated, and you can see that if you were reared by a low-licking mother, this single nucleotide is always methylated. If you were reared by a high-licking mother, it is very rarely methylated. And the reason this is important is because if this one single site is methylated, this site can no longer bind to NGFIA.
It seems that once they reach adulthood, there seems to be a certain fixed pattern there. And so it almost sounds as if it's irreversible.
It's not. And that's where I'd like to go with this part, because I think that's where it really starts. That's where the term plasticity comes in. And what you want with plasticity is to be able to move it in one direction, if that's adaptive and positive, but to be able to reverse it if it's not. And that's where I'd like to go.
So, in other words, there's a kind of a certain permanence to it, but if it is exposed to a new environment, it can be modified.
You're stealing my show. That's exactly this point. We can now revisit our butt. So while high levels of the transcription factor are necessary to induce or to produce the effect in the neonate, in the adult they're similar. But the difference is produced by the ability of this transcription factor to actually bind to the site. So you produce a lot of the transcription factor, but because the mother's behavior has altered the methylation, that will determine how much of the NGFIA is binding to the site and turning on the receptor. And that is really just basically what is presented in these diagrams. In the animals that were raised by low-licking mothers, that single site is methylated, they produce NGFIA, but the gene can't hear the signal. And so it doesn't respond by increasing the glucocorticoid receptor. In animals that were reared by high-licking mothers, the site is not methylated, so NGFIA can bind and increase the production of the glucocorticoid receptor. And you can actually measure that again in the living brain and show that in the adult animals, the binding of the interaction between NGFIA and the glucocorticoid receptor gene regulatory site is very much a function of the quality of maternal care in the first week of life. Now, we can talk about then creating an alteration in the environment of the DNA and its effects on a particular gene and thus on the way the animal responds to stress. We can also talk about, in fact, some evidence for that and why this whole methylation process is so important. What I mentioned to you earlier is that if you methylate, if you put a methyl group onto the DNA, you fix that particular site. The way you fix the site is by attracting these proteins that are histone deacetylases that prevent the acetylation of these tails. If that site is not methylated, then transcription factors can bind because the tails can be acetylated. What that would suggest is that if you could inhibit this enzyme, you might be able to reverse this effect. Right. And so that's exactly what we studied. We took adult animals who were reared by high or low licking mothers, and we treated them with a drug, trichostatin A, that inhibits this particular enzyme. What we would expect then is that even in the animals who were reared by low licking mothers, is that if you inhibit this enzyme, is that these tails can now be acetylated, and NGFIA can now bind to the site. And that's exactly what happens. Now, on the left...
So this is a purely chemical process.
At this point, yes. But we'll open up other possibilities in a few moments. All this graph tells you is that if you treat these animals with the enzyme inhibitor, is that NGFIA can now bind, even in animals who are reared by low-licking mothers, it can bind to the site as well as the normal offspring of high-licking mothers. We know what NGFIA does. It binds to this regulatory site and increases the production of glucocorticoid receptors. You would then expect that lows, who were treated with this compound, would produce as many glucocorticoid receptors as a normal animal reared by a high. And that's exactly what happens. What you then expect, of course, is that the stress response now should be different. And that, too, is exactly what occurs. This is the response, this is the stress hormone, the corticosterone in the rat. If you look at animals that were reared by low-licking mothers, as I showed you before, they show an exaggerated response to stress. Down here in this cluster are animals that were reared by high-licking mothers. But also what you find are these animals in purple who were infused with the compound and who now are producing stress responses in the same way as a high. So what's important, of course, is that you don't just change the effect at the level of the chemistry of the DNA, but you change it at the level of function for the animal. Now, and this is where we get to the idea that probably influences other than drugs may be able to produce the same effect. We can obviously ask the question how maternal care alters the chemistry of the DNA and its methylation. And one of the interesting answers came from a very simple experiment. We were looking at the methylation of a very specific site on the DNA. We decided to simply ask the question, what does that look like at different times of development? So we looked at animals prior to birth. And prior to birth, it doesn't matter whether your mother is a low-licking or a high-licking mother, there's no methylation of this particular site at all.
Prior to birth? How do you check prior to birth?
You really want to know?
Okay. Do you still mean the offspring?
Trust me, we do. Okay. When you look at the animals after birth, right, different animals, what you find now is that there has been a lot of methylation occurring, and it's occurred equally in both the animals born to and reared by highs and born to and reared by lows. In both cases, this single site, this critical site here, is almost completely methylated. But what then happens is as the pups receive different levels of licking and grooming, in the lows, this methylation remains stable throughout life and into adulthood, which comes as quickly as 90 days of life in a rat. Whereas in the pups who receive a lot of licking, there is a removal of that methylation. There is what appears to be a process of demethylation, that is going in and actively removing the methyl group, which means that the methylation can be reversed by an environmental event. And we have a little bit of information on how that may occur. Our collaborator is an absolutely wonderful molecular biologist, Moshe Zif. And a number of years ago, Moshe discovered a protein that has the ability to remove methyl groups. And this protein is called MBD2, methylated DNA binding protein 2. And it can actually remove methyl groups. And if you look at infant animals that are being reared by high licking mothers, there's more of this protein bound to the site and presumably removing methyl groups. Now that we don't know, but that's the assumption. Now this is an event, a chemical event,
thank you,
that takes a period of time. For even in vitro, when you're doing this experiment simply in glass tubes, it still takes at least 4 days to occur. But what it suggests then...
The demethylation.
What it actually suggests is that the chemistry of the DNA can be very dynamically regulated by the environment. And that's, if you will, a more optimistic message, I think. But the chemical processes for that event are known, at least in part, and we have evidence that they can occur in response to environmental events. And one can only then imagine, as we spoke of yesterday, what type of events may give rise to alterations in the chemistry of the DNA, and thus perhaps speak of it in much the same terms as we speak of the changes that occur between the connections of neurons. Now, what I would like to do in the last part is to try to bring this back to the context. Because I think the last question that we can ask that becomes so important is, why are mothers different in the level that they lick and groom their pups? What is it about those mothers? Or more importantly, what is it about their particular environment? And what we spoke of earlier was the possibility that we could, in fact, understand these variations in mother-infant interactions as a function of the quality of the social and economic environment. And I'll take you through one last experiment with the rat that suggests that that's true, and then what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the implications of that for our own species. And here there's a very simple study that, in fact, we did. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the transmission of information from the mother to her offspring is that it does not simply influence the offspring's response to stress. It also influences, at least in the females, the way they interact with their pups. And so very simply, females that were reared by low-licking mothers become, as adults, low-licking mothers. Females that were reared by high-licking mothers become high-licking mothers, as shudders go through the room. And you can cross-foster the pups and show that animals that were reared by highs, even if they were born to lows, themselves, as mothers, become highs.
So that means it's not fixed.
It is definitely not fixed. One of the things about this form of plasticity is you don't want it to be fixed, because then you lose this adaptation. You want it to be able to move even within the individual, and certainly from one generation to the next. And I'll give you an example of how that can be occurring. Now, the essential idea here is that a stressful environment will alter the behavior of the parent, and clearly that's known to occur in humans. If you look at mothers who are high and low licking and grooming mothers, they're very consistent. Their first litter of pups, they're high licking mothers. They'll be high licking mothers in general to the second, to the third, or even the fourth litter. And this is simply an experiment in which, for the first litter, all we did was to observe and to understand whether these were high or low licking mothers. Prior to the mother giving birth for the second litter, we took one half of the animals, one half of the mothers who were highs and one half who were lows, and we exposed them to stress. We were simply asking the question of whether the quality of the environment would influence the parenting. What you find is that if you look, this is just the amount of licking and grooming over the first week or so of life. Up here in the open white circles is the amount of licking and grooming by mothers who are high licking mothers. Down here in yellow is the amount of licking by mothers who are low licking mothers. If the mother was otherwise a high licking mother but was stressed, she now behaves as if she's a low licking mother. And what you can then do is to ask, what about the offspring? When you look at the offspring, what you find, I think, is exactly what you'd predict, is that the production of glucocorticoid receptors in the offspring who were born to stressed, high-licking mothers, who behaved then as low-licking mothers, is exactly the same as that of normal low-licking mothers. In other words, it was the behavior of the mother. And what this would suggest, of course, as other studies have done in other species, is that it's largely the quality of the mother's environment that is determining the nature of her interactions with her pups and these differences in the activity of these specific genes. Now, this becomes very important, and I think what's interesting and important to understand is that we can think of these as being products of adaptation on the part of the mother and on the part of the pup. Now, the story then is that the quality of the environment alters the behavior of the mother and thus the way in which the offspring respond to stress. What's critically important to understand is that survival, the ability of the animal to survive in a very stressful environment, depends upon its ability to activate these stress responses. Glucocorticoids and noradrenaline, the major stress hormones, protect you during periods of infection. What can commonly occur in infection is that your immune system overreacts to the infection, you go into septic shock, and you die. Glucocorticoids are critical in protecting you against this event. Glucocorticoids, as you can imagine, as well as noradrenaline, protect you against famine. If you are deprived of food for long periods of time, these stress hormones activate the production of glucose and fats and allow you to survive even in the absence of nutrition. And of course, if you look at organisms that grow up in conditions that are poor, what you see often are pathogens that produce infection and long periods of nutritional deprivation, of famine. And you can then argue that it may be that under conditions of poverty, animals that are most likely to survive are those who have an exaggerated stress response. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's true, what then becomes very important is to reinterpret the behavior of the mother. That means that the mother's low level of licking may be an adaptation, if you will, to prepare her offspring for what she anticipates will be a very stressful environment.
So this is a sort of an evolutionary perspective.
That's exactly what it is. You can see evidence of these same processes in humans. I mentioned early that children who are born into a home where there is abuse or neglect show greater stress responses. If you look, actually, you can use rather simple measures. This is called a measure of parental bonding, which is simply, and you'll like this, I think, the belief that the individual has of the quality of their bond between their mother or their father and themselves. And that has a very predictable relationship with the magnitude of their stress response. Individuals who perceive themselves as having had a very close relationship with their parents show a more modest stress response. And so we can see these events, as I say, in humans as well. And of course, there are many other examples of this.
This is self-reported.
This is self-reported, exactly. It is the perception of the individual. But what's very important is that there may also be in humans evidence for this as an adaptive process as well. Again, under conditions of poverty, what you commonly see is that families become less functional, less nurturing. There is more evidence of abuse and neglect, and that increases the stress responses in the children. There are at least two wonderful studies, one done in London, England, and one done in Montreal. And both studies show that if you look at least amongst boys that are growing up in poverty and crime, that the boys who do the best, that is the boys who live, for one, who make it through school, don't get arrested and falling into crime, that those boys are boys that are more fearful, that are more stress reactive. And the understanding, the way these authors describe this, is that these boys are too timid and too shy to become involved in gangs and criminal activity. What becomes very important to understand then is that there is no bad development and good development. There are differences in development. In fact, even in the extreme, you could argue there isn't any good parenting and bad parenting. There are bad environments. And bad environments produce these patterns of adaptation, which then affects the quality of life for the offspring. It is, as a famous British essayist, Sidney Smith, put out, poverty is no disgrace, but it is indeed an inconvenience. And it is the adaptation to inconvenience, if you will, that produces these particular patterns. And these adaptations we can at least in part, and I underscore in part, understand as modifications of the gene's environment. There are clearly other effects that are going on, a number of them that will relate to what Professor Gage spoke of earlier, but this is only part of the story. And I think then what becomes important is the ability to understand the child's experience from the relationship between the parent and the parent's environment. These are just some studies that were performed in Montreal by my colleague Sonia Lipien. She's looking at the level of the stress hormone cortisol in humans in children who grew up in poor environments versus those that grew up in middle-class environments, better environments.
Social economic.
You can see that even at a very young age, that the socioeconomic, the social and economic environment is influencing the biology of the child. And what's important is that this difference can be accounted for, can be explained entirely on the quality of the mother's emotional well-being. That if, in fact, you account for differences in a mother's emotional well-being, you can explain these differences entirely, which tells you about the processes by which poverty can influence the child. You can see, oh, sorry, this is Mathieu, this is a slide lifted from the other language version of this. This is the results of a brilliant study done by Hart and Riley in the United States, looking at the social and economic environment, and in this particular case, the degree to which parents vocalize, speak to their children. And they quantify this in absolutely wonderful detail over the first life. And what you can see is that parents who grew up in middle class and are living in middle class settings are vocalizing to their children at almost 10 times the rate of parents who are growing up in the poorest of circumstances. And the last thing I'll tell you about, perhaps, is just a study, and just there are different variations of these particular studies, but just to give you an idea of the way in which Western science is using new technology to be able to study these particular questions. The hypothesis, the idea that underlies this particular study is one that's very similar, is that the quality of the environment, as measurable by many different factors, is going to then influence the quality of the mother's emotional well-being. That will influence her own endocrine state.
What is endocrine?
A hormonal state, The mother's hormones will then influence the growth of the baby prior to birth and its development after birth. And that what you can then do is to be able to understand this in terms of looking at the brain development of the child. And in this particular study, there is neuroimaging of brain imaging of the children. And it can also be studied in terms of the genetic background of the child. so as to ask the question of whether some children might be more vulnerable, more affected by these relationships. But I think we've reached a stage where we can start to study these particular issues. And what one would hope, I think, is that ultimately what these studies really will clearly define is that if one wishes to improve the betterment of children and their development, that the parents and their well-being is a perfectly appropriate level at which to intervene.
Someone
is wondering, they are very, very sad situations such as they are sort of forced pregnancy. So there's an unwanted pregnancy on the part of the mother as a result of a rape or tragic situations. So in that...
One occasion I visited, I think in Poland, I think, on a small sort of city. Children's home.
Orphanage.
That they described unwanted child.
Yes.
The mother did not want to take care. So such.
So the Isolnes is wondering whether there's been any study done on the child is unborn.
Unborn mother.
No. While
the unborn re,
while
the way the conception conceptual
conception takes place.
Chedan the mandation of the conception charity.
So his holiness is wondering whether on this biochemical and brain level, will there be a difference between a child that is conceived willingly on the part of the mother and unwillingly?
Absolutely. The mother's emotional well-being determines her hormonal state. Mothers who are depressed and anxious produce more stress hormones, glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids can actually reduce the growth.
The embryonic level can support.